We're thankful, Father, for your many blessings to us, and we're thankful for your word, where sometimes we still feel like amateurs and beginners, but we ask that you would bless it to us and encourage us by it. Help us to be more faithful in it, in Christ's name. Amen. Now, I remind you that the program in this course continues. It may not seem like we're getting anywhere in the course, but you should be getting somewhere in your own study with the reading of Penny and neither of those options. I meant to bring a form along today to find out how you're doing in the options, but this is often typical of me. I couldn't find it when I needed it. So I will do that another day. That's not one of those things that has to be done, but you've got to be doing it, especially if you're working, well, either option. If you're working on the Bible memory thing, in my own mind, there's nothing more important than Bible memory. Knowing the general content of things, knowing something specifically, in my own mind, is enormously important. So don't slough on that. The other material, conceivably, if you really got pinched, you could wind up cramming 3 hours and do a lot of work. And Bible memory is rough on it, but keep the option work up to date. I'm always a little suspicious when somebody passes you in the hall and says, well, we don't really have much to do in that course. I'm always a little fearful that they may, because I don't persecute them week by week, be dogging it a bit. So don't dog it on me. We have a saying here, and that is, if you dog it this year, you may have to dog it again next year. Every now and then you'll see a very unhappy, disgruntled, or dissatisfied student. You don't see them very often. They usually go to grace. But you'll see a very unhappy, dissatisfied, disgruntled student who's repeating a course because he took some professor lightly on that particular point. He's heard those lectures before anyway. And just every now and then you see it. Usually they transfer and become heroes somewhere else, but not always. You know, just one of those things. So don't take me weakly on that. We were talking about Mark in our last class, and Mark is what I want to discuss today. Mr. Temple.
How far are we to be read for intending for
the midterm? Midterms only cover stuff we touch on in class. That's all. That's always my policy, Mr. Templeton. I give no general assigned tests over reading things unless I tell you, here's a book I'm going to examine you over. I often ask how far have you read, just to keep it up to date. But I generally do not give exams over reading material unless I make it very specific, because I've found that it becomes counterproductive. Some guys will spend hours trying to read a book, trying to outguess the professor what he's going to ask. An Old Testament introduction I give some over a large work by Harrison because it's 1,450 pages long, and I find a lot of guys don't read it if you don't put some starch in it. So there we get starchy, but I'm not happy with it. I'd sooner not do it. So that's Old Testament introduction. So I will not give you a formal. You have to understand, too, that some things everybody is expected to know. If I never mention that Mark wrote the gospel, see, I still expect you to know it. That's just one of those things. And what day did we discuss that in class? One of those circumstances. So I emphasize that Mark is written to a Gentilic type group, emphasizing the Lord as the perfect servant. If you read too many books, you get awfully bewildered. So for years I hadn't read many books, see, and I had a book in which Mark was presented as the perfect servant, and presented as the perfect servant with great emphasis on the Son of God concept, Son of Man concept, but that particular writer liked to refer to Mark in the Son of God sense. And so for years I was happy with the formula saying Matthew, he was the King of Jews, Mark, he was the Son of God, Luke, he was the Son of Man. I've read about 3 books in the last year that reverse those orders, but while reversing the particular titles, still do not reverse the idea. The idea in Mark is the servant idea. And so Mark, in many ways, is the fulfillment of, although he doesn't use the language Matthew uses, but Mark, in many ways, is the fulfillment of the servant passages of the Old Testament, and maybe as much as any other gospel, fulfillment of the dramatic character of the Old Testament, of the Messiah. Because Mark is essentially an action book, not so much a long discourse book, but essentially an action book. If you are in your second semester of first year Greek, or if you've had a whole year of Greek, you'll discover that Mark is basically a very simple gospel to translate. We often have fellows starting in John because their memory helps them a lot. And they hardly need to know a word of Greek, and they can do pretty well in John 1:1 and thereafter. But Mark is quite a fascinating gospel to translate. It was the first gospel that I ever read entirely in Greek. That's been a while back, too. And I felt very pleased with my proficiency. I then tackled Matthew and felt less happy, see. But the rule is, if you can read one Greek, you can read another Greek with a little work and a little energy. We often set before students in seminary the goal of, while you're in seminary, reading the entire New Testament in Greek. Anybody done that? You don't. If you've done it already, you don't have, you can just say so. You don't have to feel like a show-off. Anybody in this class done that? We have at least a dozen men in the seminary who have done it. Or we did last year. This year, see, it's early to see. And again, it's no thing that you get a special crown for in heaven, but at least not known to me. Maybe the martyr's crown. But as long as one is learning Greek, as long as one's learning Greek and learning Hebrew, you ought to set a realistic goal for it. And I often challenge people, as Dr. Cohen did, to set the goal of, while you're in seminary and under a more disciplined type of regimen, to set the goal of reading the whole of the New Testament in Greek. Keeping a record of what you read, so you're honest about it. And for one course, you might have to read 1 John, and for another course, you might have to read 3 chapters of Romans. But no courses in the seminary will make you read it all. You understand that. Now, Dr. Cohen always had men keep a workbook in which every time they read a Greek chapter, in the workbook there would be a page, you know, for each book of the New Testament. And if you read a chapter, you simply initialed it in that page so that you had some fundamental approach to do it. If you just say, well, I'll start today and I'll start in Matthew 1, that gets to be a hard project after a while. My own advice is, in the Gospels, is to read John first and then Mark immediately thereafter and then move. But set a goal like that for yourself while you're in seminary, while you still have the disciplined life and the regimen a lot of other people you can ask questions to. And to try and set the same goal for the Old Testament is unrealistic. In the first place, it's about 4 times as big. In the second place, men never get nearly as good in Hebrew as they do in Greek because it's written in those funny Aramaic, you know, it's written, although Hebrew is a much easier language. But set a goal for yourself to read something in Hebrew, like the Pentateuch, maybe, which is quite an attainable goal during your seminary career. Or the Psalter. That's less attainable because the Psalms are very, very hard. And many of them are very hard. Poetry's always hard. But the Psalter or the Pentateuch is a very realistic goal while you're in seminary. So no more free advice. But anyhow, that's how it goes with Mark. Mark is pretty simple Greek. It's the Greek of actions, not the classical Greek where the genitive absolute starts in page 20 and ends on page 33. It's not one of those things. It's a very simple, his sentences on the whole tend to be short, they tend to be pointed, just very emphatic. I'll make more notes on that after a bit. I always felt myself that I knew less about the Gospel of Mark, however, than any other Gospel, maybe because it was short, and also maybe because it wasn't compacted in narratives. See, it's easy to look at Matthew and know the narratives and know a lot about Matthew. You know Matthew 5 through 7, you know Matthew 13, you know Matthew 18, you know Matthew 23, 24, 25, 26. It's easy to know the narratives, I mean the discourses in Matthew, and know a lot about the Gospel. But Mark is never quite like that. Mark is an action-type book in which things are kind of thrown at you in rapid-fire fashion. I mentioned on this chart that I passed out in class where I give general concepts and content. General concepts. See, those are not for your memory either. They're just for me, studying through the thing in a survey-type sense. But I mentioned these designations of the Lord Jesus, which largely are designations that tend to emphasize the servant role. I guess you can pursue that too far if you're not careful, but they tend to emphasize the servant role, especially the didaskale, a master-type references. We're at all different levels of Greek in this class, and I'm still at kind of a different level myself. I was never one of the great Greeks. I always thought it was a trial to be endured, but that's an alpha, that is. Well, take my word for it, it's an alpha. The didaskala in the vocative sense, see, didaskalos is the, but didaskala, master, which is the vocative, which is so common as far as the old, as far as Mark is concerned. That word in Mark is used far more on a percentage basis than in Luke or Matthew. what I emphasize there is that Mark is very short, see? So if a word is used 10 times in 2 chapters, as opposed to another book where it's used 10 times in 12 chapters, the frequency occurrence of it in the book with 2 chapters is much greater than in the other book. And Mark is great on miracles and on terms like this, see, because of that rate. His book is not so long, but the emphasis is laid constantly before you. Didaskala can be, or didaskalos, if you want it in the nominative, But the doskalos can be just a general term applied to anyone, but especially after you pass in Mark, especially after you pass chapter 10, the last week of the Lord's life, it is just a very, very big title. Master is the concept not of divinity, but the concept of servant or the concept of worker, because many of the masters, you know, were really, the masters are like the teachers of today, they were servants of the people. Many of them were slaves, not in the Hebrew culture, in the Roman culture. Hebrews had a different thing, but the master in the Hebrew culture, the rabbi, the head man at the synagogue, was really servant to the group. They had a correct view of the ministry. The minister was not a lord, he was a servant. And so when they said master, they were talking about someone who labors for the people. Yes, sir.
Can you tell me the difference between the designation of Jesus as Son of Man versus Son of God?
Well, I can only give you a rough idea. I can do that. But I can't give you the final theological thrust on it. Son of Man, I think, epitomizes him as the fulfillment of God incarnate. He is a product of the flesh. And not totally unique. Son of Man is used of Ezekiel back and others occasionally, but he is a product of the flesh, but he is flesh perfected. Whereas Son of God emphasizes his relationship with the Father. Son of Man emphasizes his relationship with humanity. Son of God emphasizes his relationship with the Father. Since he is one person, the terms cannot be fully exclusive. He's one person. He at one time, at one hand, he's the perfection of humanity. At the very same time, he's the perfection of the God-man. So he is God and man. But I look at those terms and say it's kind of a matter of what you're looking at. Are you looking at the perfect person, Son of Man? Are you looking at the one who perfectly does the will of the Father, Son of God, that kind of a concept? So I see that general distinction between them. They are not mutually exclusive. They are sometimes used in the same passage by the same person. But they tend to have that type of flavor to them. And consequently, you find them in all the Gospels, of course, because the Lord, there's no writer in the New Testament who thinks of the Lord exclusively of the one and not of the other. They all know him to be perfection in the flesh, and they all know him to be the uniquely begotten Son of God. But they tend to emphasize that, those two aspects, in my understanding. Yeah, Son of Man naturally tends to emphasize more the service role, I think. Sometimes you'd be hard-pressed to get 42 scriptures to demonstrate that, but I think the Son of Man has come to seek and to save the service role, and so forth. So I will say nothing more there about those particular designations, but they have always interested me in the nature of the gospel. When you get down to the whole thing of it, the concept of Mark is to present Christ in this serving capacity. And that is why I think he begins the book with that little expression, the beginning of the gospel of Christ. As I mentioned the other day, or I think I mentioned, Mark is the only writer who even conceivably uses the term gospel in a booky sense. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, in the authorized version. He's the only writer in the New Testament, I think, who really uses gospel in that booky sense, although there are some muted references in Revelation where some people think otherwise. But it seems to me very plain that there he is using it that way. Here's the story of the Son of God, Jesus Christ. Now, I can leave my chart in the background. I try to put everything in chart form in my own study. I have always been an inductive type, not always. Nobody's always been everything. But since my military days, when I hung around with a bunch of inductivists out in California, I tend to be an inductive type of Bible student who likes to make big, elaborate charts that nobody can understand but himself. But when you flash that chart on the overhead, and everybody's impressed that you've got a chart, half of them don't know what the lines mean. A good many don't know where the parentheses go, but they're certainly impressed that you've got a chart. And you can get a kind of a grip on it yourself that way. So I've kind of always worked that way. This is hardly an inductivist type chart. This is just a chart. Clears my conscience. Let me mention some of the things about the general content in Mark. About the general content. I mentioned earlier that it's largely an action-type gospel. I need not repeat that, I think. But you'll discover that none of the miracles are very prolonged. Just note me generally. None of the miracles are very prolonged. None of the accounts are the least bit drawn out. They are over and done with in just a matter of a few minutes. So if you go to a chapter like Mark 2, for example, in Mark 2, in only 28 verses, you pass through the departure from Capernaum, you pass through the healing of this man who was carried in by four, you pass through the justification of Jesus as the man who can forgive sins, you pass through the calling of Levi, you pass through his reputation of the self-righteous Pharisees, two parabolic statements, the treatment of the Sabbath. You pass through all of those things in 27 verses. Now, all you have to do is make a comparative reading with Luke. Luke is the great God, is another discourse-type gospel. All you have to do is make a comparative reading and see that on virtually every subject, Matthew and Luke will take a lot more space to say what Mark says. Now, some things they discuss, he doesn't discuss. He mentions some things they don't mention. That, I think, is probably normal. But he is essentially the gospel of few words. It's an action-type thing. You flow through it with great vigor and with great authority. There are a lot of significant features in Mark. The significant miracles have always struck me. I give a list of them here, arranged in a grouping, which I should have identified when I listed them on page F. The first group, of course, are miracles of healing. The second group are nature miracles. And the third group are miracles over evil forces. And the fourth one, which is only one reference, is the raising of someone from the dead. That could maybe be put with something else. But I've listed them in those three connections. I'm not sure why, just because the night I was working on that sort of thing, that's the way it appealed to me. If you could figure out all the reasons why things appeal to you, your life would be simpler, I suppose. But the healing miracles, of which you have just two that are unique to Mark alone. But that's the deaf and dumb man in Mark 7 and the Bethsaida blind man in Mark 8, on whom I later have a lengthy excursus on one of the later pages in this note. But the healing miracles, I guess this would be true in every gospel too, but the healing miracles are these miracles done in a compassionate sort of a sense that demonstrate the feeling of Christ for those who suffer. They demonstrate the feeling of him for those who suffer, but they always do it in a legal and in a proper way. So this example in Mark chapter 1 of the leper is a beautiful example in which Jesus moved with compassion. That's Mark's great language. Jesus moved with compassion, put forth his hand and touched him and said, "I'll heal you, be clean." And then 3 verses later tells the leper, who was cleansed, you see, he says to him, "See that you don't say anything to anybody, but go thy way, show thyself to the priest, and offer for thy cleansing those things which Moses commanded." The healing miracles in Mark have a touch of that humanity to them. Again, I might exaggerate a bit. You see, I've got a point in mind. When you get a point in mind, you pull all the scriptures to fit it. But without wanting to corrupt anything, but the healing miracles in Mark have that particular point of compassion, but yet legal compassion. And so when the Lord heals someone on the Sabbath and the Pharisees say to him, "Why do you do it?" Immediately you know that he doesn't do it in contradiction of a ceremonial law when he's been so precise with the leper to make sure that the leper's healing is according to law. The cleansing of a leper is a big thing in Leviticus 14. And in effect he's saying to the leper, he says, "You're cleansed and you know it, but the law pronounces for the benefit of society that you should go through a ritual. Now you go and show yourself to the priest and go through that ritual." Hence the man was not only cleansed, but the man would be able to stand ceremonially. He could go to synagogue 2 weeks. It'd take 2 weeks. But in 2 weeks he could go to synagogue and take his place. You got the thrust of what I'm saying there. See, in Luke, it's the healing of 10 lepers and the healing of a lot of other people too. And the narration is just simple. He healed them, they went away, and he wonders why they don't all come back and thank him and so forth. But it's a healing kind of thing quickly. But in Mark, you get that sympathetic sort of understanding in the miracle that the Lord heals and restores not only the individual, but him to his place in society. So you get this vivid account of the Gadarene maniac, which is found in the other Gospels also, sketched in Mark 5. The account is found in the other Gospels also, but in Mark it is really a full account. In fact, it's unusually long for a Mark-type account. You can see that simply by comparing numbers of verses. Unusually long for a Mark-type account, but goes into great detail as to the restoration of the man to his family and to his place in society, and concludes in verse 19 with Jesus' words to him, go home to his friends and tell them how great things the Lord has done for you and how he's had compassion on you. He having compassion is one of the big things in the servant in Mark. Now, I don't want to ramble too much, but if you simply stop and think of religious workers, then the superiority of Christ the servant on that basis alone has to stand out in your mind in Mark. The concept of compassion and mercy, but that leading people to a legal restoration of where they were in society, it really has to grip you somehow. I, of course, work in the world of religion all the time, and the first thing I discover is that there are not many that are really compassionate. There are not many evangelists that are really compassionate. There are some. There are a lot of them that preach well, but when the meeting is over, they're tired and grouchy. There are not many that are really compassionate. And of all the people I have attempted to follow over the years who profess to be healers, real compassion is hardly ever evidenced among them. There may be some, see, I don't know them all, but there was a time when I knew quite a few of them, listened to a lot of them. It's easy to talk about being compassionate to the people who are starving in India when you live here. Or it's easy to talk about being compassionate for those who are in the, you know, hospitals and sick and whatnot and so forth, as long as you don't go to the hospital. But if you're compassionate, you reach out and find people. Or if not reaching out, at least when you come across them in life, you find them. So, so you see, it's like walking along in Philadelphia. Everybody has their own views on these things, but here's a fellow who sits down at the train station in Philadelphia. He's been there as long as I've been around Philadelphia. He's a blind man, I think. I've never asked him. He sits there. He's somewhat crippled, too. He sits there selling pencils with a cup in front of the station, the railroad station in Philadelphia. I don't think I've gone in twice when he wasn't there. I invariably buy a pencil. Invariably. I mean, he's not going to get rich off me, but I invariably put a quarter in his can and take a pencil. I always take the pencil. I think that builds the ego of the salesman. But I don't argue with anyone on that either. I just take one, too. But I always put a quarter in the can and take a pencil. And I've had people say, you know, he's probably rich. He probably drives three Cadillacs. A lot of other things. He might be. If he is, then the Lord will deal. He might be. On the other hand, when I look at him, I can't help but say, I wish there was. If I could reach out and touch him and heal him, I would do it in about 2 minutes. See, I wouldn't even need a crowd, and I certainly wouldn't need the TV cameras. I feel for him a tremendous emotiveness. Now, if I find out years later from now he's a phony, that's all part of the game of life. But I have no reason to think it now. And I feel for him a tremendous emotiveness. Well, that's characteristic of the servant in Mark's gospel. That healing and that compassion. I won't elaborate on that further, I don't think. But in all of these accounts, you will detect that. Most of them are quite quick, but the Gadarene maniac is a long one. Now, in the demon miracles, where the Lord is confronted with demons, the most impressive thing is that the demons in Mark are quite quick to identify him. As I note somewhere, either in this course or some other course, the demons know him better than the rabbis do. They're quite quick to identify him. For example, in Mark 1:24, let us alone, Jesus of Nazareth. We know who you are. We know that you are the Holy One of God. They know more about Jesus than the Pharisees do, obviously. The Sadducees are the religious leaders. Of course, so we understand the spiritual overtones in that. But in Mark, the demons know who he is and know what he has come to do. Art thou come to destroy us? The implication is yes. The same thing is true with the demons and the swine over in Mark 5. They sense that the servant has come to restore the house, or to put it back in order, at least in some of its parts. So that even those situations in confronting the demons in Mark and become demonstrations of the perfection of his service. I mentioned a bunch of other things beside miracles, or try to. The literary features quite captivate me, although they don't do much for you when you're preaching, I don't think. It's amazing the stuff that interests you in seminary that doesn't interest anybody the rest of your life. For example, when I mention the key Greek constructions, eutheos, immediately or straightway. Mark is full of that. In Mark, everything is in a hurry. I, by nature, am a slow man. But in Mark, just about everything is in a hurry. And the great expressions in Mark for moving quickly and rapidly are very, very pronounced. It's always Jesus straightway coming up out of the water. The next day, he immediately moving. A lot of the verbs are kept in a running future and in a running present type of sense. Just a very emphatic type of circumstance. Variant endings, variant words, quickly, hastily. All I can tell you is that in the Greek construction, you get the feeling of Mark of being in a hurry. Plus, this interesting use of the middle Marco.
Always had trouble with that Greek letter.
Always had trouble with that. You all have enough Greek. See, I'm not one of the big Greeks. Did I tell you that before? I'm not one of the big Greeks. I did my 2 years of teaching first year Greek and I retired. They were all glad too. I never write accents. Who wrote accents in antiquity? Nobody did. Nobody did. We invented them. They're like the Hebrew vowels. I try not to write them too. But when you're learning, you write everything. See, when you get to an elevation, when you're learning, you write everything. Out of Arco, you know, or out of Arcomai, huh? But you're surely all in enough Greek that you can read my writing with some effort, I think. At least I hope that's the case. Alpha, Yoda, Omai, Arco, or Arcomai, depending on that sort of thing. But the use of this particular expression, the use of that particular expression, he was beginning. He began to do, with an infinitive following in Mark, is one of the outstanding Greek structures. And the emphasis always is, see, that there is a flow. Now remember a tricky thing about the aorist for Greek scholars. The idea that the aorist is past time is a bad idea. Get that out of your skull. The aorist suggests a completed action in point of time of the viewer. And just because 90% of the things that are complete are in past time, a lot of students think of the aorist as being in a past sense. But don't fall into that trap, and it'll save yourself a lot of grief later on. Think of the aorist as showing something complete at a given point. And what that given point happens to be, that's in the mind of the writer. A lot of things that are complete are naturally past, but some things are still future, and you'll find the aorist occasionally used for a totally future thing because in the mind of the writer, it's done. Of course, when you get into the aorist infinitives and participles, then you lose all of that sense. So that the aorist infinitive, the aorist participle, the aorist infinitive in particular simply suggests the punctiliar looking at a thing. So when you're urged to present your bodies in Romans 12, it's to present them with an aorist infinitive, given as an act, a single completed act. Well, in this particular situation, see, the emphasis is, he began to do, he began, and the emphasis is on not the finished thrust of it, but the continual motion that was involved. And it's not only true of Jesus, it's true of all, it's Mark's language. And I mentioned the passage in Mark 8, 31 and Mark 8, 32.
To what extent would Mark be trying to get the flavor of Jesus' ministry? I've heard accounts saying that he would put even Billy Graham to shame with all of his work.
You mean Mark?
All right, Jesus would put any evangelist or anybody to shame because he's so busy. To what could, you know, is there any proof or any ideas that what Mark is trying to do is get the sense of Jesus?
I think he is trying to portray certainly the immediacy of Christ's ministry, that Christ didn't dawdle around a lot. But I personally follow the theory that Mark was strongly under the influence of Peter. And Peter, of course, is a man of action, whatever else he is. Like him or not like him, he is essentially a man of action. He doesn't stand around feeling the sword blade for a long time. He swings it. So I personally feel that Mark is very much under the influence of Peter, who's a man of action. And the Lord, I do feel that Mark is portraying the immediacy, the urgency of Christ's ministry, because he's the perfect servant. And the perfect servant, well, there are times when the perfect servant stands, but the perfect servant doesn't goof off a lot. He hustles. He's about the will of his father. Of course, that's a Matthew citation. That ought to be in Mark. The perfect servant hustles. So you have all sorts of expressions like this one I referred to in Mark 8:31, where the writer says, Kai erxato didas kain autus. He began to teach them that it was necessary for the Son of Man to suffer many things and to be reproved by the elders and by the high priests and by the scribes, and to be killed. All of these infinitives follow erxato. He began to teach that all of this line of things might happen, and after 3 days to rise from the dead. And then Peter, we are told in verse 32, when he spoke of these approaching things, then Peter began, and the same language is true of Peter. See, Peter began to reprove him or to speak against him. That construction is just striking in Mark. It gives you this thrilling kind of a narrative type thing. But again, it's hard to preach. It doesn't edify the people very much to stand up and say, 72 times we have erxato followed by an infinitive in Mark. But for yourself, it gives a sense of the intimacy of the gospel, a moving narrative. The historic present, in which Mark regularly uses a present, but when you translate it, you have to translate it really like a past tense. The historical present used in Mark, Tenney says 151 times. 150, maybe Tenney says 150, or maybe he said 151, I wrote it wrong. But that's a lot of times in the nature of the historical present. For example, I just opened to see, and he comes unto the house. That's Mark 3:20. I look over this page and I immediately see a half dozen of them, historic, and he comes unto the house. Not he came, but when you translate it, you'll have to render it came. Because obviously it's over now. But the use of the present in an historic sense, and he comes, rather than and he came, to keep you moving with the force of it, because it's a gospel of immediacy and a gospel pressing those particular things. Now you do have passages with an aorist sense where he talks about John and Jesus having come into Jerusalem to proclaim the kingdom of God and so forth. But again and again, you get that striking use of the present. And along with it, many times, the participles. And he came, coming, that sort of a thing. I just quickly see that without even batting two eyelashes at Mark 1:21 and so forth. But the emphasis of the historic present is very big. That's using the present tense to describe something that's already over, so that you get a feeling for it as if it were moving right on today. Now, when people try to translate Mark very literally, if you translate all those presents literally, it hardly makes sense. And he comes to a house, and he said to them, see it. But so when we translate it, we regularly translate the historic present as if it were a past. But it's part of the immediacy concept that's thrown at us in Mark's gospel. Those things are all part of the fine points in the Greek text, and what they do for me is give me a flavor, a feeling for the gospel, but they don't give me much to preach. You know what I'm saying there, I hope. Hope you do anyway. If you don't, ask me later. Now, I mentioned also some interesting language constructions of which I will say very little. You'll discover that in Mark 1:38, for example, in Mark 1:38, well, I'm certainly glad I brought my own book today anyway, and don't have to pull this where Mr. Gospodinsky's, but in Mark 1:38, the King James text renders it towns, if I remember rightly. Is it under towns? Yes, just towns. But the Greek text is komopolis, country towns. Just a very quaint little expression, see? Just a very quaint little expression. And I've always wondered why they didn't do it in the King James. It's one of those things that that you can't really figure out, I suppose. Let us go unto the next towns that I may preach there also, for therefore came I forth. But the Greek text actually says, let us go unto the approaching country towns, the rural villages. Doesn't that strike you as a warmer expression? Oh, who cares? But anyhow, it's typical of the language of Mark to use that sort of language. There are at least 30 of them altogether. I have mentioned merely two here. which in the King James Bible you will not often see, but you'll see them quickly with your English concordance. And the presence of Aramaic words, I've listed five. I don't know if there are many more or not. Those are the five I have in my notes that I no doubt copied out of somebody's book. But you come on them quickly in your own English reading, and the healing of this maiden in 5:41, Talitha Kumai, which says, little girl, get up. Little girl, get up. Talitha. Little daughter, little girl, child, get up, kumai. But it's Aramaic. Now, that's only one of the many reasons that help us think that Jesus spoke Aramaic repeatedly. And that, of course, some things in one language are just approximated and brought over into another language. So you have many words in this in our language, but many words, if you go to another land, you'll find that the word for telephone in English and French and German is disgustingly the same, except they may emphasize it a little bit different, or the accent may come somewhere differently. It's a long story, my attempting to use the telephones in Germany, but we'll not even get into it right now. So the word is just transliterated. So an expression like Talitha Kumai, but there'd be no point in transliterating a thing like that. It's one of those tricky things. You can say, get up, kid, in Greek as well as you can say it in Aramaic. But it seems to reflect the passion of Mark to depict the words of Jesus in a rather forceful thing. Abba, on the other hand, Abba, the cry of the little child, no doubt, no doubt, no doubt. When I say no doubt, that means I don't have any doubts. You know what babies say first in life? Well, they usually say mama first. Hate to tell you, fellas, they usually say mama because mama is a bilabial stop sound. And almost any kid, sooner or later, crying will go ma-ma-ma. Almost anyone, and the diligent mother hears mama. And the father usually does it too. You know, some of them start talking at 3 weeks with that kind of a sound. Ma-ma, it's a bilabial, it's a pork baby. That's the way you learn to talk, see? Papa usually comes somewhat later, but two is a natural sound. Well, Abba, Abba, Ba is the immediate following sound of Ma, 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 Ma. And one is a stop and the other is a pushed. So most scholars don't have any doubt at all what Abba is. Ab is the Hebrew word for father. Abba is the Aramaic. And most scholars have no doubt at all what the Aramaic Abba is, maybe taken from the Hebrew the father, but is more likely the little child's particular designation. Of course, it comes to be in good language, just like a word like daddy does in due time. I always kind of hated that one myself, but I get things worse than that, so I have to have it. I mentioned also Mark's fondness for diminutives. And there again, you'll need your lexicon. The English will not do it for you because the English has the habit of well, again, I don't know why. Now, in the case of Mark 7:27 and 8:7, the parallel chapters in Matthew also use the Greek term diminutive for little dogs and little fish. But in Mark 5:41, with this healing of this little girl, and in Mark 5:23, with Jairus, with the daughter, in both of those situations, the Matthew account does not use the diminutive. Mark uses that alone. And many scholars think that that's, again, his perception and the vivid nature of the account. So they are little dogs, little daughter, little boat. Whether the tip of the ear qualifies or not, but I thought it was worth putting in my list of diminutives. That could be multiplied, too. It's not an exhaustive list. He's fond of that type of, we call it, action speech, see? Action speech. So the woman is talking about the children and the crumbs from the table. Now, Matthew uses the language, too, so it's not exclusively Markan, but she's talking about the children and the crumbs from the table, you know, and the Lord says, well, we usually give them to the little dogs live under the table, the puppies. You know where the big dogs are, they're out guarding the property, certainly. Well, the puppies, we usually give them to the puppies. That isn't literally true either. Little dogs is literally true. Whether they are puppies or whether they're chihuahuas, or heavens, what a thought. Whether chihuahuas and Bible tops. Yeah, maybe they were, what are those long dachshunds? Yeah, dachshunds. And maybe toy terrier, I don't know, but little dogs is an interesting thing. If they were dogs like my dog, you don't give them to them under the table, they sit in the chair. Yeah, but that's the thing. Say, the Hebraistic style, again, doesn't give you much to preach, but it's an interesting thing. And one of the fascinating things with regard to Hebrew is the way it likes to repeat things in a slightly altered form. You'll find a lot of that in Mark. The carpenter, Mark 6:3, the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James and Joseph and Judah and Simon. That's what we call a conceit in language studies, a conceit. It's not this, it's very easy to say, is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary? But suddenly, see, the Hebrew element, the Hebrewistic idea is you make a thing emphatic by multiplying the speech figures. And so, no, it's not just Simon, the son of Mary, it's the brother of James and Joseph and Judah and Simon. What's more, his sisters are here too. That's what we refer to as an Hebraistic thought. When you get translating Hebrew more, you'll find tons of that sort of thing in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, it's fairly uncommon. Fairly uncommon. Although certainly a certain amount of it occurs. We think that that, again, probably, I like the Peter thing. In Mark 5:12, a little different touch. But again, a very striking duplicate type of idea, which is very common in Hebrew. All the devils besought him, saying, send us into the swine. You could stop there, but that we may enter with them, or enter into them. Hebrew, you'll discover Hebrew does it repeatedly in the Old Testament. The same thing is said twice, and you say to yourself, why didn't he, the Old Testament would only be half as long if they always stopped at the given point. But that's the nature, and so people like myself who think that Peter had a big hand in Mark's gospel are prone to look at this and say, well, there's evidences of Peter, the Hebrew thinker, see. And now it's certainly what the demon said. Don't misunderstand me on that. But you have to recognize in the gospel accounts, all of them only give us a certain amount of the totality that was said. When John says that if all the things Jesus said and done were written in books, the world wouldn't be able to hold them, depending on what he means by world, of course, that may be something of a hyperbole, but certainly it has the great ring of general truth to it that the Lord did thousands of things that aren't told us. You don't doubt that, do you? So what we have in the Gospels is an accurate account of what he said, but representatively selected. And so here is a representative selection revealing that kind of an Hebraistic background, I think. But I don't split any churches over it. But I think it pretty keenly. And then this narrative force, which is so common to Mark, mentioned by me on 8. I have copied out the two accounts with the normal amount of spelling mistakes. These two miracles are peculiar to Mark. Peculiar to Mark. They do not occur in Matthew or Luke or the Gospel of Thomas. They are peculiar to Mark. So, notice how similar they sound, although they are quite different. And don't see there, but it's Mark's style to depict a thing graphically and visibly. He cometh to Bethsaida, and they bring a blind man unto him, as opposed to the passage in Mark. Actually, this is Mark 8 on the right, on the left, and Mark 7 on the right. They are just in the wrong order. It's Mark 8 on the left and Mark 7 on the right, because sometimes when I do things, I do it that way. Actually, I thought it was typing 7 on the left and 8 on the right. I got through it, and it's just undone, you know. Well, he cometh to Bethsaida, they bring a blind man unto him. Another account in Mark 7, and they bring to him one that was deaf. The emphasis is on the word they doing it to him, see, they bringing to him. And he besought him to touch him. He had an impediment of speech, and they beseech him to put his hand upon him. Do you get the flavor of that narrative continuity? Now, you can follow that the whole way through, see. He took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the town. In the case of the other man who was deaf, he took him aside from the multitude and put his fingers into his ears. The concept of spitting on his eyes, spitting on his hand, the concept of touching his eyes, touching his tongue, the concept of looking up and seeing what he says and so forth, those things are, it's the style of Mark, a kind of a narrative force in which the key things are action words. The action words just boil in the text. So when you read Mark, you're really reading an exciting gospel. Although the way a lot of our scholars read it, it doesn't come out that way, but you're reading an exciting gospel. And the force in the narratives is on action words and action events. Nobody stands around in Mark dragging his heels. Now, I'm not saying that in any sense putting down any other gospels. I'm just mentioning each one has its own thrust. Matthew is busy showing Christ as the King of the Jews, the logical fulfiller of the messianic promise, and so he has long discourses that build to that end. Mark has almost no long discourses at all. Mark is a gospel of action showing service and work. Luke will have long sections of teaching, rather different than the Matthew discourses, but long sections of teaching. And John will have long sermons, you know, in the scope of it, each one emphasizing this particular thing. And Mark is emphasizing the nature of the servant, and the servant is not a fellow who twiddles his thumbs a lot. He gets on with the job. Now, there are a lot of things that could be omitted from any course, I suppose, and so I offer just two quick oral notes. One of these is quicker than you believe. Mark has the eyewitness account without any doubt, see. And there are lots of things to indicate that. I've mentioned a number of them down here under the Mark and Peter relationship. although we don't think that Mark was there himself. There's a lot of speculation. You know, when the Lord was taken captive, there was a youth who ran from the presence of the scene. Somebody reached out and grabbed him and grabbed his cloak and said something, but the fellow tore off and ran off in such haste that he ran right out of his clothes and ran away naked. And of course, they were not clad like we are today. They wore a kind of a toga, a kind of a wraparound, a kind of a throw around. So running out of your clothes was not the problem that it might be for some of you. I shouldn't have even thought of that. I go to a coffee house over here from time to time in Berwyn, where they've had a very excellent ministry. There are places that do poorly and there are places that do well. And in Berwyn, they have an excellent ministry. They've developed a full-fledged fellowship out of it, and it's just been an excellent ministry in reaching people and helping people. So I remember one night I was over there, and a couple of years ago, and the big fashion at that time, in this particular academic, they work hard on the Villanova students and characters like that. But the thing that was the big fashion was this monk's gown type of dress that about four fellows and three ladies were wearing that night. It looks like an old army poncho. It has a hole in the top and a hole where the arms come out and a sash pulled around the middle. It just looks like a giant, looks like you're walking in a giant bag. And I must say, I couldn't help but wondering 100 times if that was all they were wearing. I couldn't help but wonder 100 times. I'm sure if I wore a garment like that, I wouldn't cumber myself with a necktie and a lot of other stuff. But some think that Mark was that youth who ran away. Some think. In fact, a lot of people think it, but nobody knows for sure. But he certainly was not one of the 12. You know that. We always get amused on this freshman test, you know, with regard to Bible knowledge, asking the names of the 12 disciples. Almost invariably, there'll be a half dozen fellows that will start out with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and then add 8 other names to that. Frequently add Simon and Peter. None of us are as smart as we think we are, but it's just amazing how many think that Luke and Mark were with that company of 12 that wandered around with the Lord. Well, Mark may have known more about it than we know because of his family intrigue, but he certainly wasn't one of the group. But there's a lot of eyewitness flavors in it. He saw that it was the tip of the ear that the sword cut off. He saw that, see. He saw this chap run away nude, be he the chap or be it somebody else. A lot of eyewitness thing. He hears the very words on the sea. He records them. And many, many other unique little points. So we've always noted that he certainly is dependent. Of course, they're all dependent on the Spirit of God. But he certainly is dependent on a force that knew eyewitness material. As far as the peculiar data of Mark is concerned, Dr. Newman will give you about 2 pages on that in Gospel History. So we just leave that for Newman. A lot of other things can be left for Newman, too. It'd be comforting when you get to Gospel History to say, where's all this stuff on the peculiar data of Mark? He'll say, what stuff? But your mentioning it to him will make him get it out. On the Mark and Peter relationship, I sketch kind of freely. I will say very little about it. And then I wanted to make a note on the basic mark and material. You get the feeling I'm rushing? That's right. It's a survey course. You're always rushing in a survey course. The author is Mark. Note that. I think Peter had a lot to do with it. I really do. And of course, in my mind, the great reference to that is the reference in 1 Peter 5. Marcus, my son, saluteth you. Mark is one of those interesting men in the New Testament. He goes with Paul for a little bit, then Paul doesn't want him again. He goes off with Barnabas. We don't see him for a long time, but the next thing we know, we find Paul writing nice things about him and saying that Mark is with him and a comfort to him. And then we find Peter writing from Babylon, which I really think is Rome, a speech figure, but he says, Marcus, my son, salutes you, he says. And so many scholars think that the mark of Paul's commendation, the John Mark of the Acts account, the mark was with Peter, and the man who wrote the gospel are the same Mark. There's lots of good evidence for that. Of course, in that situation, he no doubt had the benefit of revelatory materials both from Peter and from those associated with Peter and also from Paul. So we say he's the author of the gospel. We don't mean it lightheartedly. But when people say, well, we thought an apostle had to write all of the books, and the church has regularly thought that the apostle Peter was the authority behind Mark, like the apostle Paul is the authority behind Luke. They've regularly thought that. They may be surprised someday and decide that an apostle wasn't needed at all. But that's regularly thought. And Mark, in my work, Mark is one of the earliest dated of the epistles. Last year, 2 years ago, the academic world was hit with a great stunning shock. when Father, what's his name, O'Flanagan, and a couple other fellows found a tiny fragment from latter Qumran findings in Palestine, which they dated at about 53 A.D., which purportedly were fragments of the Mark Gospel. Father O'Callaghan was the big man in that. Anybody see that article a couple of years ago? It was quite exciting in the academic community that this Catholic scholar found what he regarded as a fragment of Mark's Gospel dating from about 53 A.D. in the Qumran literatures of the Christian era. That's still an open question. The fragment is so small, and the exact wording so limited, and so admissible of about three designations, that nobody... It's kind of fascinating, though, to think about, because if you found a fragment from 53 A.D., it would be mighty close to the autograph. It would have to be, you know, just by nature. Mark couldn't have been written before 33 A.D. If you found a fragment 53, it certainly wasn't written until he matured as a Christian, you wouldn't think. He certainly didn't write it as a kind of a diary while he was on that first missionary journey. And it's quite an exciting thing. But the O'Callaghan fragment is still up in the air. Well, actually, it's under glass in the British Museum, but the discussion is still on. I have about three things to finish on Mark on Wednesday, including some notations on Mark 16. I'm about an hour behind now. I'm probably about to drop behind 2 hours, because it's inconceivable we'll cover Luke on one day and John on one day, but we'll be through pretty quick. It's a survey course. Grab.